On first thought, you'd probably think that they actually shouldn't have any physical significance at all, based on what we've known. So two operators that we think are, that at first you might think they don't matter at all, they're completely fictitious, but by the end of the lecture, I'm going to tell you that their coefficients have to be smaller than 10 to the minus 9. So what are these two operators? In the process, I'm going to have to tell you about anomalies and CP violation and the strong interactions. But first, let me just introduce these two operators. Two operators that shouldn't matter. The first thing that I'm going to tell you seems like it shouldn't matter, but actually does. Goes back to looking at our quark mass matrices. So we have things like our U-right conjugate, M up, Q, H. We know the quark mass matters, but based on what I've been saying before, you would think that the phase, the argument of the determinant of M, so that's some overall phase in the mass matrix, you would think this overall phase can be rotated away by the U3 left cross U3 U right conjugate symmetry. In particular, since it's an overall uniform phase, it's useful to break these U3s up into an SU3 left cross a U1 left cross U1 right cross SU3 right. And it's these U1s. When I take, say, I can group these into two combinations. I can regroup this as a U1 left plus right, under which I rotate the left and right-handed quarks by the same amount. That means I'm rotating the U-right conjugate, that's an anti-quark field, by the opposite amount as Q. That doesn't change M up. So this is called the vector U1. And if I go back, and for this it is useful to go back to our Dirac fermions, if I go back to Dirac fermions, I could write that as e to the I alpha times psi up. So the whole quark field is being left or right-handed quarks are being rotated by the same phase. Call that alpha v. The other U1, so this one doesn't change arg.m. In fact, it leaves this whole mass matrix invariant. The other one I can call left minus right. And this is called the axial U1. It takes psi up to e to the I alpha a gamma 5 times psi up. And that, if you break it up in terms of Weyl spinners, that's transforming the Q and the U right conjugate. Sorry, I guess I should be consistent here. I'll just talk about the mass and leave the Higgs out of it. Or I could write lambda V, lambda H, but I shouldn't write MH. U right conjugate and Q in this case transform with the same phase. So if I were to rotate by phase alpha, that would change the effective phase of M up by 2 alpha, of this overall phase in M up by 2 alpha. Right? And the same for, there's a similar down term. D right conjugate and down q. So really, I can get m, or I can write this as a sum over all the quarks of the argument of the quark mass. Okay? That's a phase that you that up to now, we would think that phase should not have any physical importance, because this U1, this axial U1, is a symmetry of the Lagrangian, and I can use that symmetry to rotate that phase away. So it can't possibly affect physics. Does that make sense? Okay. I hope it doesn't make too much sense, because it'll turn out to be wrong. But but it's almost right, and it's important to understand why it's almost right. Yeah?
Sorry, I probably missed something. Why is it that the axial U1 is the relevant group, not the vector U1?
Because the vector U1, so the vector U1 is basically is rotating the two quarks the same way, the left and the right-handed quarks, which means it rotates the left-handed quark opposite to the right-handed anti-quark.
So the mass term breaks that.
The mass term is invariant under the vector U1.
Oh, I see.
So that means that the vector U1 can't be used to get rid of that phase. Okay. So that's why that phase shouldn't matter, because we can rotate it away using this U1 symmetry. What's the second term that shouldn't matter? Well, the second term that shouldn't matter is I can write down a correction to the Lagrangian. This is something I mentioned actually a long ago. D4x theta over, I'm going to put some 64 pi squared down here, just as a normalization, just because. Doesn't make that much sense right now why I would. But I want to normalize it to theta with a theta over 64 pi squared. F mu nu, sorry, for the gluon. So G mu nu A, G rho sigma A, so I'm tracing over the color indices, A equals 1 through 8. And I'll contract those with an epsilon mu nu rho sigma. Now, why would I say this shouldn't matter? I'd say this shouldn't matter. It looks like it should matter, right? It's a gauge invariant operator. It's got dimension 4. Why would I say this doesn't matter? I say this doesn't matter because if I massage it a little bit, I can write it as a total derivative. I can write GA mu nu, GB rho sigma. Each of these, of course, has differential operators, epsilon mu nu rho sigma, as being equal to twice, and I'm going to get the factors wrong unless I look at my notes for this one. Put the derivative outside as being del mu of the quantity 2 epsilon mu nu rho sigma a nu a del rho a sigma a plus a third FABC okay, so you can check this using the explicit formula for these g's in terms of, right, each g has two parts. Each g, mu nu a, has a part that's a derivative of a nu, plus then it has a term that involves a commutator of two a's, group commutator, then f a b c. I don't have all the coefficients right in here, but this is schematically what it is. And when you contract two of these things, you see all of these are very anti-symmetric. That means, for example, that this del mu acting on this term, well, it may look like there's two pieces when I use the product rule to expand it, the del mu acting on the a nu, the del mu acting on the a sigma. But because there's already a del rho acting on the a sigma, and these are anti-symmetrized, the second term vanishes. So that total derivative is actually just equal to the del mu a nu del rho a sigma part of the g squared, of the g, g anti-symmetrized. And if I likewise, if I look at this term, there's three different terms, but I can use various relations to make them all, the anti-symmetry of this and the anti-symmetry of the epsilon, to make them all look like they're coming from the anti-symmetrized product of two g's. So what I just wrote there is a contribution to the Lagrangian that's just proportional to a total derivative. The total derivative of this object here, is often called C mu G mu, it's called the Chern-Simons class. So why on earth am I going to write down a total derivative in my action? Seems like as long as I impose reasonable boundary conditions, the field's going to go to zero at infinity. Well, maybe it's easiest to say first why this term is actually important. It's because what we really know is that at infinity, g mu nu goes to zero. The field strength goes to zero. Why? We have no reason to think that a mu should go to zero. After all, a mu isn't doing anything physical. I'll give you an argument that actually we can't take a mu to go to zero at the boundary. This is all we know. Turns out there are solutions there are solutions that go to zero at the boundary as just 1 over r. And really, strictly speaking, what I'm talking about here are solutions that go to the boundary as 1 over r in the Euclidean path integral. So I mean as 1 over, maybe I should give it a name, x squared, which is defined as x, you know, the analytically continued ix0 squared plus xi squared. But I really don't want to, I just want to mention that there is a bit of a technicality of going to the Euclidean space. I don't want to emphasize the details of that. There are solutions that go to 0 as 1 over x. Don't go to zero all that fast, still have vanishing, very fast vanishing g mu nu. Okay, the way to think about these, yeah. So I've analytically continued, when I talk about going to zero in the Euclidean path integral, What I mean is that if I wick rotate the time component,
the time is imaginary.
Then I've got imaginary time. Right. Yeah.
Because you have your chunk factor, are you saying you can formulate the theory on a complex vector bundle?
There is a way of relating it to vector bundles. So yeah, I mean, I'm actually not an expert on that, but there's a close relationship between the, I believe the way of formulating it is that you can think of AMU as a bundle on the group manifold of the SUN. But yeah, I'm actually not that comfortable with this formulation gauge theory, so I'm not going to try to answer your question. Many other people here will know. So these AMUs at the boundary, if you take AMU, if you just pick, let's say AMU is an SU3 field. If I just pick a group element of SU3, for each direction of x, okay, then I can take G inverse times grad I G of x hat, spatial gradient, call that the sort of limiting, have AMU of x approach that at large x. AI of x. Have AI approach that at large x, large Euclidean x. That field configuration has the property that g mu nu goes to 0 at the boundary. As long as A approaches this form fast enough, even though this A expression isn't going towards 0 very fast, g mu nu approaches 0. Like g mu nu is strictly 0 for this configuration. So as long as A rapidly approaches this, g mu nu will rapidly approach 0. And these group elements, they don't all have to be the same for every x. So now we get into the topology of the group and the topology of the space over which, of the boundary of space. So if I'm really talking about this as a Euclidean four-dimensional A, yeah?
But the del,
yeah.
Not a covariant derivative.
Not a covariant derivative, I don't think. Actually, might be, I'm not sure.
It's pure gauge, right? So it should be the second term, the gauge transformation is a pure gauge term. It's probably not covariant.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, the none of the details of this will actually be essential to the story, to today's story. What's very crucially important, though, is that there are non-zero, there are these configurations. And they can be, every configuration that approaches pure gauge can be decomposed as a superposition. So I can classify them, first of all. I can classify them by, let's take this group, this SU3, right? And that's like the three-dimensional, then that has spheres inside of it, right? That has little SU2s inside of it. And if I look at the boundary of space, that's also a sphere. So I can wrap this group around the boundary of space. I can have a non-trivial dependence of what this g is on the angle I'm going. Yeah? Because, right, for four dimensions is a three sphere, and I also have one of those. Yeah. Right. Well, yes. Yes, good. So I have my four dimensional Euclidean space. I have a three-dimensional boundary of that four three sphere is the boundary of that 4D space. And then I've got an SU2 which can wrap it. Clearly, there's a requirement, right? This, you can only get non-trivial wrappings for certain groups in certain space-time dimensions. If the space-time dimension is 4 and I've got a U1, I can't wrap that. If the space-time dimension is 4 and I have an SU2, an SO2, I can't wrap it. SO2 just does circles. F, it's the same as U1, so I don't know why. SO3, I can't wrap it because that's just a 2-sphere. But in 3 dimensions, I could wrap SO3, right? So this characterization, mathematically, this is just the pi d minus 1 of the group G, of the gauge group G. So the topology of this is very nice. Generally, you can classify it. But again, just intuitive, the intuitive way to picture it is that you have your group, well, is to go actually go down so that we can visualize it, to thinking about a 2-sphere wrapping a 2-sphere, right? And you know that a 2-sphere wrapping a 2-sphere, well, you could have your function, you can map the sphere, think about wrapping one balloon around another balloon, right? You could contract the, you could have every point on the sphere give you the same value, the same position on your little group balloon. Or you could imagine that every time you go around the sphere, your position on the sphere directly translates to your position in the group manifold, right? So if I'm as I'm up here, I'm also up in some sense relative to a reference coordinate system on the group manifold, and I could imagine doubling it. I can take my group balloon and, you know, twist it around on one side and curve it back over the spatial sphere and end up with, now there's sort of 2 coverings of, as I go around the sphere, I get the same value at both poles, right? And I get a wrapping, a non-trivial wrapping that actually I cover the group space twice as I'm crossing the 3-dimensional space. So and you can do this as many times as you want. In general, for an SU2 subgroup, the pi d minus 1, this group, is just the integers. This is basically saying that you can wrap the assignment of a G to X as having either n-fold redundancy for any n. Okay? And if you look at any 2 solutions that are, if you look at a solution that has winding of 1 and a solution that has winding of 2, a solution that has winding of 0, and you ask, is there any kind of small gradual gauge transformation that I can do that takes me from one to the other? Something that's so is there a continuous family of gauge choices that gets me from an AI with n of 1, with some n, to an n prime in terms of that wrapping? You can't. They're not continuously deformable into one another. You have to really do this discrete change of the fields in order to get from one to another. Or go through, you can do something continuous, but it's not just a gauge transformation. It would involve actually raising significantly the energy stored in that field. So the reason that this total derivative matters is that we do have to consider in our theory these AIs that have non-trivial winding number. And actually, it turns out that I don't really need to worry about all the different possibilities for these AIs. The only thing that is physical that I do need to pay a lot of attention to is the winding number. So I can sum over, think about different sectors of gauge fields with different n different winding numbers of that solution. And then continuous deformations from each one to the others. Now you might think, and when those winding numbers are non-zero, so I said there's a sort of topological invariant, right? There's a way of classifying globally the global structure of a given AI. And the way of writing that global structure is very closely related to this total derivative. It's just the integral over the boundary surface of an FABC ABC and this is a surface, so there's a direction, so these have mu nu rho. If I contract those with a mu nu rho sigma, and then there's a surface element that has a direction sigma, which I can contract in. So of course, those of you who want to relate this to differential forms over a surface will find it very easy to do so in terms of just a wedge product of the A's. But we can also just write it out explicitly in coordinates this way. So what have we got? We've got these sectors with different ends. And you might ask the question, what does the field actually do? How do we handle these in our physical theory? Can we have a theory that sensibly just restricts to a single end? There's actually a nice, very physical argument. I'm not sure. It's in Weinberg's book. I'm actually not sure who came up with it. For why you can't think of just n equals 0. And the argument is this. Say we have some very large region of space, and you do a calculation in your n equals 0 theory. So you've restricted to the boundary condition that the winding number of the field has to be 0. But it's a really large region of space. There's lots of different things going on in it. And there's no reason that I can't divide it into two regions of space. And now my boundary condition will still allow me to have fields that, to a very, very good approximation, look like winding number n fields, approaching zero field strength at the boundary of this large region, but non-zero winding number of the gauge field. And then minus n over here. And so any calculation that I want to do, I'd have to sum over n of the expectation value for my relevant operators over here, call him O1. In the n vacuum, times an expectation value for some operator O2, times just some expectation value. Maybe I'm not asking about any operators in this region. This is region 1. This is region 2. In the minus n state. And then I'd have to divide by my usual divergent vacuum contribution I have, which is just a sum over n of just my n, my trivial expectation values. Right, this is in terms of in and out states, there's nothing there. If I were to write it in terms of the free states, I would put in just my e to the is, but never mind that. Okay, and this would not be equal if I were restricting to winding number 0, this would not be equal to just a simple sum over n. Or rather, it wouldn't be equal to what I would have gotten in a theory just restricted to live over here. Right? This would not be equal to the sum of O1, 0, over my trivial vacuum matrix element. 0. Because there would be contributions from all the different n vacua. So this tells you that you really need to consider physically all of the different n vacua simultaneously, that they all have to play a role in your theory. If you want physical observables to factorize, that now if I ask the question, what's the probability of, now I can go from talking about trivial operators to non-trivial operators in both. If I want to talk about the probability of process number one happening here, process number two happening at Alpha Centauri, both very, you know, small scale processes, right? Maybe they built an LHC near Alpha Centauri, but that's really small compared to our distance. That I shouldn't need to know what's happening at the Alpha Centauri LHC in order to predict the results at my LHC. So that actually this should factorize. It should be equal to some sort of a 102. Now, how can I possibly make that so? I can do that by letting my theory sum over, say, M, the, yeah.
So this factorization would happen when the argument of the operator O1 and O2 becomes, the difference becomes large, right?
Right, so when the O1 just involves local stuff happening over here, and this is a very large region compared to the interpoint separations involved in O1, and O2 is a local operator that just involves here. The way to do this is to now let N1 and M2 and the total N, which is N1 plus N2, each have some, let weight each vacuum in N by some Fn. So now I have a sum over N of Fn, and then I have a sum over N1, and this has to be N minus N1, right? Sum over N, Fn. You can show that if Fn equals Fn1 times Fn2, whenever n1 plus n2 equals n, then the sub-theory living in O1, ignoring everything that's happening over here, gives me exactly the same result for my calculations as the full theory, which seems like a very important property to have. And that singles out that Fn is equal to e to the I theta n for some theta. I mean, I could obviously multiply this by an arbitrary constant. That really wouldn't be changing anything. So I really need to sum over all these sectors with a weight. And this theta in the Lagrangian is just telling me how to weight those different sectors. Yeah.
You probably mentioned this, but so this thing that you've written, that's the thing that takes the value n.
Yes.
If we normalize it using 1/64 pi squared.
Right. Thank you. And I think there may well be an I in front of it as well. Okay. So that was perhaps a longer explanation earlier than I intended of why operator number two matters. But now it turns out what's sort of surprising is that these two very different seeming operators both appear at first glance to be unphysical. They're actually very closely connected. The connection between the two comes from the fact that this U1 is anomalous. Now, by the way, I apologize that I'm sort of stating a lot of things in an imprecise way and then moving on today. But there is a lot of non-perturbative physics behind this problem that's very intricate. And I have 2 days. And so I want to get to the part of the story that has observable consequences relatively quickly. So we've seen the story for operator 2. What about operator 1? Well, this is where anomalies come in. I told you, and you can check for yourself, that this axial U1, the one that rotates the mass matrix, is a symmetry of the Lagrangian. That means that in the classical theory, there is a charge and of the Hamiltonian. In the classical theory, there's a charge that commutes with the Hamiltonian. It has a vanishing Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian. If I read this as the Hamiltonian acting on Q, it means that Q dot equals 0. If I read it as Q acting on the Hamiltonian, it's just the statement, totally equivalent statement, that the Hamiltonian is neutral. And Q can always be written as a spatial integral d3x of a j0, where del mu j mu equals 0. It's just the Noether current. It's a symmetry of the Lagrangian, but it's not a symmetry of the full quantum theory. Of the full QFT. In particular, del mu j mu is equal, you can do this calculation in a couple of different ways. Convince yourself that del mu j mu is nothing but a 1 over 16 pi squared coefficient times this object, f mu nu, f rho sigma, epsilon mu nu rho sigma. Actually, I think I was off by a factor. sorry, I want to separate off that equation. These are the G's. And in general, you do also get contributions with F mu nu's. But the F mu nu is less transparently physically an issue because there it really is a total derivative. There's no topological invariance that tell you that it should be important. So there's this, plus in general, there's also some F mu nu, F rho sigma terms. And actually, each one of these has a coefficient. I'll call this the AG, AM. Those coefficients turn out to be just related. These coefficients are basically related to a sum over left-handed fermions of, well, to write this in a way that generalizes to non-abelian theories. If I imagine making a big vector of left-handed fermions, all of them, up quarks, down quarks, you write conjugates, etc., I can write every symmetry transformation in my theory as some matrix acting on these psi's. Right? Every symmetry I can associate to a T And I'll call it a T alpha. The alpha distinguishes that this isn't any flavor space of a particular group, the group space of a particular group. This is just the long, long tower of left-handed fermions. These anomaly coefficients end up being proportional to the trace of the symmetric part, T alpha, T beta, T of the, so my J mu axial, this is my J mu axial here. It has a modified conservation number law. It also has some TA, right? So I've got my T alpha beta, sorry, I've got my T's, and then alpha and beta here are different, actually different generators of different symmetries. Yeah?
So what can you mean what T alpha is?
So T alpha is a matrix. So if I have a symmetry generator alpha, takes this big monster vector of left-handed fermions to a matrix T times psi left, T alpha times psi left. So if I have 15 left-handed fermions in my theory, this is a 15 by 15 matrix. It might be very simple.
What group is
this?
How do we determine T alpha?
Right, so suppose I had, so if you know how a group, basically it comes from the representations of each of those left-handed spinners under the group. So for example, and this is sort of a needlessly general notation for most practical purposes, if my theory has a triplet of under SU3, then I put each component, U1, U2, U3, where these are color indices. And I put in my charm1, charm2, charm3, where these are color indices, all into a huge column vector. And then, since both of these are triplets under SU3, my T alpha for an SU3 generator, for an SU3 generator A, would have my lambda A up here and a lambda A down here. So this is just a very, very general notation for how the symmetry acts on the set of all fermions in the theory. And then if I add leptons into my matrix, then I'm just going to have trivial actions, zero on the rest of the matrix. So by looking at those, all I really want to say is that there's a general rule for computing these anomaly coefficients in terms of the sum over left-handed fermions of the charges of those fermions. And when that sum is non-zero, which it is for this axial group, you end up with a modification to the current conservation condition. So TA now is the same vector is the same matrix, analogous matrix constructed for the U1 axial. Okay, for the symmetry whose anomaly I'm calculating. So that symmetry, we thought it was a symmetry, but actually del mu J mu doesn't vanish. That means it's not a symmetry, and a symmetry of the full theory. It's not an approximate symmetry either. I mean, you could try to, because you can't treat this perturbatively. The gauge fields are getting really important at low energies. This is a parametrically large breaking of the symmetry. And you might ask, well, what the fact that this is exactly the same coefficient here does mean that actually the two different operators I wrote down, they're both physical, but they're both equivalent. Yeah.
So I'm trying to get the general notion of what you're doing here. So are you trying to use the topological invariants of your gauge theory, which are the tenth classes, to do calculations in your gauge theory?
Yes and no. So yes, so you need to know, so the fact that there are non-trivial Chern classes tells us that has to be included in consistently describing the theory, right? And I argued with the little two regions argument that actually you have to include all the different sectors with different churn classes in the theory. And you have to include them weighted in a particular way to get nice behavior. Once you include them in that appropriate way, that is totally equivalent to putting, or that can be encoded by the theta, by that theta parameter in the Lagrangian. That essentially, it's a sum over different sectors in the path integral with an e to the I. That's actually sort of easy to see, right? Because you're summing over different sectors in the path integral with an e to the I theta n. If you put that, that's in the exponent, so you can, and then if you write down the this expression for n, right, then you can massage that, call it part of the Lagrangian, because the only invariant thing is what is the thing in the exponent in your path integral. So you can group that e to the I theta n into your Lagrangian and call it the theta term. That's the physical interpretation then of the theta term, is really what sector of the theory in terms of that weighting do you live in. Now, totally separate point, albeit connected mathematically, is the first one, that actually the phase of that mass matrix can't be rotated away by any symmetry of the theory. Okay, so that's a totally distinct point coming from the fact that the symmetry that you wanted to use to rotate it away, this axial U1, isn't a symmetry of the full theory. It's a symmetry, one formal way to say it is that it's a symmetry of the Lagrangian, but it's not a symmetry of the path integral. And I skipped the calculations because they are fairly mathematically involved, but it's straightforward to set up the calculation of this anomalous current in terms of actually what the symmetry does to the measure of the path integral. Roughly, because you have this, if you think about your path integral as involving d psi's and d psi bars, that measure is actually rotated by that axial U1. Now, actually getting from that sort of heuristic statement that the measure is rephased, that you need to account for that, to this formula, that's a lot of work. That's why I didn't even try to go into it. But that's the statement, is that when you try to do that rotation on the full path integral, it induces a term of precisely the same form that we were considering earlier because of the vacuum structure. So two separate origins. One is the axial anomaly. The other is the non-trivial structure of QCD's vacuum. But what they both contribute to, in the end, they both contribute to this churn-like term in the action. So I can absorb them all if I want. Sorry, one moment. I can absorb them all into an overall choice of theta and then forget everything that we talked about motivation-wise and then just ask what are the physical consequences of that theta. But there are two distinct sources. Yeah.
So we could also calculate that using Feynman diagrams.
You can also calculate this using Feynman diagrams. So or you can calculate it. You can't show that this is, you can calculate certain expectation values. You can talk about an operator like this, calculate its vacuum expectation value, where these are, say, two QCD currents. And then I can take this one's an x, y, and z. I can differentiate that with respect to x and contract them all, epsilon, mu, nu, rho, sigma. The expectation value in here is just a triangle graph. So I've got my JA here, basically just encoding different weights of the different weights here. I can do the loop momentum integral. But when you're careful about this del x, you again find a non-zero coefficient, which is precisely the sum of traces. So there are a lot of different calculations where this anomaly shows up. I wouldn't really call this calculation a derivation of this as an operator expression because it's really a particular expectation value, but it's closely related. So maybe we should ask at this point, well, do we really know that this, I mean, I've gone through a lot of, or rather I've sketched out a lot of non-perturbative arguments, a lot of fairly involved statements whose proofs take, you know, take many pages in Weinberg, who has a very nice, Weinberg's volume 2 of field theory has a very nice treatment of all of this stuff, by the way. But it would not be doable in 2 lectures, so my apologies. The upshot, you might ask, is this really physical? Do we have any evidence that this is real? And the answer is yes, we do have 2 pieces of evidence that this is real. 2 pieces of evidence that this anomaly in particular matters. The first one comes from the chiral Lagrangian itself. And I know Mark mentioned this briefly, but I should mention it briefly again. If you look at the simple chiral Lagrangian, the one with just the up and the down quarks, right, and then you try to build a sigma that transforms under SU2 left and right to account for the low energy degrees of freedom, if you took the symmetry group under which the sigma was symmetric to be a U2 left cross U2 right, spontaneously broken to a U2 vector-like, then you would have ended up with 4 light particles associated with the 4 spontaneously broken symmetries of the U2. And we know there's only 3 light particles associated with these, the pi plus, pi minus, and pi zero. There is another particle that we can kind of think of as being part of this U2, or rather the full of this U2 structure. It's the eta prime. Formally it's called the eta 1, which is a linear combination of the mass eigenstates, eta and eta prime, but you don't really want to get into this. There is an eta, but the point is the mass of this eta is around many hundreds of MeV. Something like 800 to 900 MeV. I can't give a precise number because it's not even a mass eigenstate. But there's no evidence. In fact, the evidence contradicts the possibility of there being this U2 symmetry respected by QCD. A full U2 symmetry broken by the QCD condensate. And says, no, that U2 symmetry, it wasn't really in your theory. If the U2 symmetry was in your theory and it was spontaneously broken, you would have had a light particle associated with it. And we don't. We only see 3 light pions. Then another somewhat more technical point is that if you look at the pi zero decay rate to 2 photons, that's how pions decay, you could actually calculate it either assuming that there was or that there wasn't a U1 axial symmetry in your theory. If your U1 axial symmetry, if your theory had a U1 axial symmetry, the pion spontaneously breaking it, then there's going to be an additional suppression to the pion decay lifetime coming from that symmetry. And you would have gotten a pion decay lifetime calculated from that that was 10 to the 3 times longer lifetime than is actually observed. So the pion lifetime is confirming that this picture that the anomalies are really, really destroying your symmetries is correct. Unfortunately, if you take this seriously, which we seem really to be forced to by both by the calculations and by the data in the standard model that requires you to take the anomalies very seriously, you also find that the combination of that quark mass phase and theta is some physical thing. And that physical quantity should be observable, and it violates parity and it violates CP. And it violates them in a flavor-blind way in the strong interactions. So in things that involve, say, just strong interactions up to up matrix elements, right? Because that's just part of it. It's in an up quark mass. Nothing suppressed by a heavy mass scale, nothing suppressed by a small mixing angle, just breaking CP and parity in the strong interactions. I should be a little careful, because the object that I'm really talking about is the determinant of a mass matrix times e to the I theta. This is really the observable thing. It's the phase of this object. Clearly, if the mass matrix had a zero eigenvalue, then its phase would be ill-defined, can't possibly be physical. In other words, if the mass had a real eigenvalue, another way of thinking about it is then, sorry, had a zero eigenvalue, then I could go up and instead of using my uniform rotation to get rid of the phase, let's say m up equals zero. That would imply that in a general basis, or in a mass eigenstate basis where I've done all my SUN rotations, but where I've done SUN rotations, but I haven't done the final overall U1 of the U3, I have 0 times some complex me to the I phi and mod me to the I phi prime. I could get rid of all my phases by just doing relative rotations. I could do a relative rotation of B against S to get rid of the, to make these the same phi, right? I could rotate by phi prime minus phi over 2 and him, and rotate by phi prime plus phi minus by the inverse of that on the B. That would bring this to something with the same phase on both of these, just by a relative rotation. That's part of the SU3. That is not anomalous. And then I could do a rotation of both of these against the zero mass eigenvalue. And that would bring me to a totally real mass matrix without ever using the U1 axial symmetry. So if one of the masses is zero, I can make this phase vanish. I can make it whatever I want without using the U1 axial symmetry. And this theta angle should be unphysical. That tells me there's at least one suppression going into the CP violation by the strong interaction, right? It has to be suppressed by the mass of the up quark, or equivalently by the mass of the pion. And so if you look at the kind of observable that is something like the electric dipole moment of the neutron, sorry, you would expect that to go roughly like m pi squared over m neutron cubed, I think. Times the electron charge. Just from these CP violating QCD effects. Would give you an electron, a dipole moment that goes like this, suppressed, of course, by theta. So we would have expected an electric dipole moment of the neutron of this order. And that works out to about theta, if I convert it to CGS units, 10 to the minus 16 e centimeters. That's what you'd expect for theta of order 1, if this is physical. Note that this m pi is taking into account my quark masses. So fine. That's the EDM. What's the measured EDM? Well, we haven't seen an EDM for the neutron. As far as we can tell, it has no electric dipole moment. The bound is that it has to be less than 3 times 10 to the minus 26 e centimeters. So that tells us that this theta parameter should have been order 1, has to be less than about 10 to the minus 9. We have two sources. They're both a little bit complicated, but they're both real, of CP violation in the strong interactions. And yet the measured amount of CP violation is suppressed by 9 orders of magnitude. So this is probably one of the biggest failures of the standard model as a predictive theory of particle physics. Obviously, there are things the standard model doesn't include, like gravity, but it just manifestly doesn't try to include them. This, I think, can be legitimately pointed to as a failed prediction of the standard model. So there are ways of getting around it. I mentioned one, this possibility that the up quark is really massless. There's various simulations that I'm also not really an expert in, but lattice calculations to try to convince yourselves that it's really not possible for the up quark mass to be zero. That's what's currently believed. It's current wisdom. But I don't know enough about it to tell you how dead certain it is that the up quark mass isn't zero. Another possibility, which we'll talk about next time, is that there's the idea of axions, which solve this problem by taking this theta angle, the physically relevant theta angle, and making it something that actually has a dynamical degree of freedom associated with it. Yeah?
When you say the up quark mass may be zero, do you mean its QCD mass?
I mean, yeah, good. So I mean its mass at some energy scale being zero. So if there's any point at which its Yukawa coupling is zero, then I can repeat these any mass scale, then I can do these arguments at that mass scale, and running shouldn't be generating a large theta term for me. Yeah.
Just to make sure I understand the exact problem with the small theta, this isn't just a fine-tuning problem, right? Like, as in we say that, you know, there's no apparent reason why the neutrino masses should be tiny, they just are tiny. Is that a fine-tuning problem where, like, there's no apparent reason why the theta should be so small, like just, but we could set it to be really small by hand, it's just arbitrary?
Yeah.
Or is it more like the Higgs problem where we have this issue where the Higgs is, like, where the Higgs max is vacuum unstable, and so then it's not even, like, technically natural? Like,
right. So I would say it's somewhere in between, because the neutrino masses, while they're small, it's very easy to explain why they're small, because there's an enhanced symmetry in that limit that seems like it could be an in principle symmetry that comes from somewhere in the theory. Whereas the Higgs mass being small, so the Higgs mass, there's no symmetry that's restored when it's small. And there's no, and there are large quantum corrections. So Higgs, no symmetry, large quantum corrections. I guess I won't write because I'm running late. The strong CP problem, there's also no symmetry that's restored. But there are the large quantum corrections. There's just these two tree-level sources that have to be fine-tuned against one another. I don't know if I should call them tree-level, but there's two physical sources that are dictated. They are determined by parameters of the tree-level Lagrangian.
So you technically could just by hand.
You could tune them to 10 to the minus 9. But unlike the neutrino case, where that even seems like it's an enhanced symmetry limit of the full theory, here it's not very compelling, because we know CP is broken, just basically all to hell by the weak interactions. I mean, it's observed as a small effect, but it's observed as a small effect because of the real mixing angles being small. The CP phase is actually pretty large in the weak interactions. So there's no hint at all from the weak interactions that CP is special, is a symmetry respected by the full theory. Whereas it does seem to be sort of eerily respected by QCD. So I would rank it in between the hierarchy problem and the neutrino mass problem, in terms of sort of conceptual severity.
So you're saying that the mathematical structure of the standard model is not quite right?
Right, so yes. Now whether that involves, now you can ask, there's sort of two different paths that you can take to try to make the mathematical structure, not, you know, to try to resolve it. One would be to change in some way the physics of these very, this sort of the boundary physics, change the importance of these instanton corrections, of this winding physics to the theory. Nobody really has a compelling way of changing that. So the way people modify the mathematical structure instead is by just adding an extra particle whose dynamics naturally favors the CP symmetric state. So that's the axion solution. That's what we'll talk about tomorrow.